and we were on these, the 21st and 22nd, yeah, 20 and 21st chapter of Mosiah, on the important subject of how to deal with an enemy, and just about every situation comes up. Marvelous how these things are analyzed here. You get the impression that it really was carefully edited. So, you notice in the sixth verse of the, down to there, of the 20th chapter, the Lamanites are literally up in arms when the girls had been missing, failed to show up. And Limhi discovered their preparations from the tower. We saw how a little glitter was enough to give it all away. And they're dealing with the enemies, a general ambush. They're greatly outnumbered and so forth, and the general ambush is sometimes very effective. There's been some beauties. The best, I suppose, was Zhukov's ambushing of von Pauli's 6th Army. The entire 6th Army was ambushed. Surprised the daylights out of them. They're not as bad as we were surprised in the Bulge. Well, anyway, that, and they fought like dragons, as we saw in the Phratries, and then the king is wounded and he's brought in, and they immediately want to put him to death because look what he's caused them and so forth. And Limhi says, nothing doing. Let's find out what's going on first. He asks reasonable questions. There's no threatening or bullying or righteous indignation here. And then King Laman explains why. Of course, we didn't break our oath. You didn't break yours. We didn't break ours. But you did. You stole those girls and so forth. And Limhi's reaction is not boys will be boys at all. He says, well, let's find out who did it. And they'll be severely punished, though. And he immediately launches a full-scale investigation to find out who's to punish him. But old Gideon's at hand. And he was the one who had kept check on Noah's crowd, as you know. He was the one who'd gone out. The many of Gideon had made contact. He wasn't there, but they'd made contact and reported to him about these hiding priests out there in the sticks. And so Gideon says, don't blame your own people and until you've checked on your father's immoral priests loose in the jungle. And we'd better explain them to the Lamanites. We'd better do it in a hurry. And then we're just at urgent speech where because yes. Behold, or hinna. So I want to put it that way. For behold, he may tell his people to be satisfied because they're getting ready to head back right now, he says. And they're preparing to come against us. Behold, they're just a few of us. We're in a bad fix. Behold, they come with their numerous hosts and accept the king to pacify them. For not the words of Abinadi fulfilled. Now, this is the old fire eater Gideon speaking. And he's the great patriot and so forth, but he says, it's our blame. We're responsible. We are their author and original, as Titania says. Are not the words of Abinadi fulfilled? He prophesied against us and all this because we would not hearken unto the words of the Lord. And now this is, as I say, the old fire-eating Gideon speaking. He says, now let us pacify the king, and we will fulfill the oath which ye have made unto him. Notice he's being very realistic. These are the steps by which the problem is solved here. It's a very touchy thing, but they solve the problem very sensibly on both sides, a thing people rarely do. And he says, being a realist of all people, where's your Patrick Henry? He says, it's better to be in bondage than to lose our lives. Well, that's a terrible thing to say. Sooner red than dead, dead than red, and all this sort of thing. We have our slogans that never get any farther than slogans. Therefore, let us put a stop to the shedding of so much blood. I say Gideon's the last man you'd expect, but Gideon he had the experience of these things. He knew, and it's the old commander who knows. The most passionate talks I've ever heard against war and army have been by generals, without any exception. They know what it is, and boy, do they light in. Such wonderful ones from Bradley and Max Taylor and so forth. Eisenhower said some pretty strong things too. Therefore, let us put a stop to so much shedding of blood, he says, with his rush of excitement. And then, remember, I say, this is the Gideon who chased the king with a sword up at the tower and all that sort of thing. And he is the one who's making a plea to put an end to all this bloodshed, whatever we do. Limhi explains about his father and the priests in the wilderness as the most likely kidnappers. And notice what Limhi does in the 21st verse here. He takes the blame for his father's behavior in 2021 here. We got it here. Wait a minute, I've got 2021. But he takes the blame for his father's behavior, and the king is pacified. Let's go forth to meet. Well, everybody does the sensible thing. He's the realist. Bondage rather than dying are our sins. We must stop this foolish bloodshed. Then Limhi has the courtesy to explain everything to the Lamanite king. See, that's the 32nd verse. Then instead of standing tall, the king humiliated himself. Imagine, the Lamanite king humiliates himself before his own people to plead for the enemy. Can we imagine doing such a thing today as that? Both sides are being very reasonable, and they solve their problem here that way. Yeah. The king was pacified, and he said to them, "Let us go forth to meet my people without arms. I swear unto you with an oath that my people shall not swear thy people." It came to pass they followed the king, and he went forth without arms to meet the Lamanites. It came to pass that they did meet the Lamanites, and the king of the Lamanites did bow himself down before them and plead in behalf of the people of Limhi. None of your standing tall here and refusing to make concessions. And then, the most important element of all, the humanity of it. And when the Lamanites saw the people of Limhi, that they were without arms, they had compassion on them. You have to have the humanity too, and that solves it. It's going to appear a number of times here that the Lamanites are always more merciful than the Nephites when they have the upper hand. It's a very interesting thing. The Indians will still spare the whites, and not the other way around. I have some wonderful things on that. Well, anyway, when the Lamanites saw the people of Limhi, that they were without arms, they had compassion and were pacified toward them and returned to their, with their king in peace to their own land. Now, that's a happy solution to what been a, could have been a long and nasty war, but they were pretty fed up on that by now. But then things are back to normal, and you'll notice, but it's still human nature. It only lasts for 2 years. The people get restless again. It's an unstable situation. The Lamanites resent the prosperous Nephites again, as we... The defeated Nephites, they resent them just as we resent the prosperity of the prosperous defeated Japanese and Germans. After being beaten, they immediately ran circles around us in the things we excel at, namely making money. And this is the same thing here. The people became, again, they'd always been too nervous about these industries. You know, they brought them in the first place, remember, so they'd cultivate the land. The country was run down, that particular area. They let them come in. It was a trick the king played. It was this man's father, you see. He played this trick on them to get them to settle. Then they really began to prosper, and it made the Lamanites worried. And it begins to happen again. After many days, the Lamanites began to be stirred up in anger against the Nephites. They begin to come into the borders of the land round about and start harassing. You see, that's the way it starts doing. They couldn't kill them because they had this oath which they'd made to King Limhi. Isn't that nice? They observe their oaths. You know, we observe oaths too, as long as it's convenient, which they made to King Limhi. But our oaths with the Indians, our treaties with the Indians, for example. Well, there's some beauties. But they would bother them, and doing what Indians would do, they were brutal. They'd hit them in the face and boss them around, and then put burdens on their backs and drive them as a dumb ass, and that was the prophecy. You see, they started bullying them. Yea, it was done that the word of the Lord might be fulfilled. They had brought it on themselves this way. And this should cause us concern here. This is not a blessed land unconditionally. The promise is the same for every people that shall inhabit the promised land. I'm going to read the second chapter of Ether on that, which is very good here. That's slightly getting ahead of the game, as you'll see. But this is what the promise is, I say. This fact, notice these people, they've been good for a long time. They've been valiant, they've saved themselves up, but the time isn't up. They still have to pay a price here. And so we have this situation here. And he has sworn in his wrath unto the brother of Jared that whoso should possess the land of promise from that time henceforth and forever should serve him the true and only God, or they should be swept off when the fullness of his wrath to come upon them. Until then, everything fine, business as usual, as it was in the days of Noah, you see. They bought, they sold, they gave in marriage, they married, and so forth. They ate, they drank, they did all the normal things, and then suddenly it hit them, and that's what the Lord says is going to be like. And now we can behold the decrees of God concerning this land, and that it is a land of promise, and whatsoever nation shall possess it shall serve God, or they shall be, again, swept off. There's the condition. Swept off when the fullness of his wrath shall come, and the fullness of his wrath cometh upon them when they are ripened in iniquity. Notice fullness and ripening. When the cup is full, you can't add anything else. There's no reason. You can't dilute it. You can't do anything about it. And when the fruit is ripe, if you let it go on ripening, it'll just get rotten. So when the fruit is ripe, it is plucked, but he waits till it is ripe. And he waits till the cup is full. Now, how soon is it going to be full now? You see things going on. For behold, again he repeats it the third time, for behold, this is a land which is choice above all other lands, true. Wherefore, he that doth possess this land shall serve God, or shall be swept off. For it is the everlasting decree of God, and it is not until the fullness of iniquity are among the children of the land that they are swept off. So he's going to let them go all the way. It's a very interesting pattern, you see. And this cometh unto you, ye Gentiles, the inhabitants of the land, that ye may know the decrees of God, that ye may repent and not continue in your iniquities. The assumption is here that they are wicked, you see. Not continue in your iniquities until the fullness come, that you may not bring down the wrath of the fullness of God upon you, as the inhabitants of the land have hitherto done. Behold, this is a choice land, and whatsoever nation possess it shall be free from bondage and from captivity and from all other nations under heaven, if they will serve the Lord of God, who is Jesus Christ. So that's the condition, but it's a very close thing in that case. You have to do more than we're doing if you're going to serve the God of this land. And it's very clearly stated there the way it happens. And it happens all of a sudden. Notice this is unique. They're still writing all sorts of studies about the disappearance of the Toltecs and the Mayans and the Aztecs and so forth. And there are some theories, but nobody has the vaguest idea why they disappeared. The point is that we have ruins and we have remnants of people, Aztecs and especially Mayans and so forth, and Quechua people. And in Peru, everywhere, we have the scattered remnants of these things after it's broken up. But the civilizations have gone, all the whole length of the thing, gone completely. But in the old world, that doesn't happen that way at all. The people sin and go on sinning, they suffer, they pay for it, but it's a going concern. They pay as they go. There are the Greeks and the Arabs and the Chinese and the Hindus, and the Egyptians were an ancient civilization when Lehi left Jerusalem. And they're still there. Their languages, customs, everything are still there. They were not swept off. They suffer, my gosh, how they suffer, what they go through and so forth. The Russians, for example, stradach, 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 suffer, 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 like the Moscow Art Theater. But you have to go through that. But we don't. It's different here. We prosper, we make glorious, powerful, free, and everything else, and we take advantage of that, and if we start misbehaving, it's a hard test, you see. Who can stand prosperity? Nobody has stood it yet so far. That's the Book of Mormon. And why does this come to us, you see? Well, all the others have fouled up, but we never shall. In that case, why have such pains been taken to give us the warning? Not that we may be saved, but as the Lord says, that they may be left without excuse when they get hit. We can't complain, we didn't hear. Now here, for example, with all their vans, with all their succeeding, they fought like dragons. They're going to do the thing again, but they don't pull it off at all. In the fourth verse. Now the afflictions of the Nephites were very great, and they couldn't stand it very much longer. The Lamanites had surrounded them on every side. I say they were in a trap, they were in an enclave. And the people began to murmur with the king because of their afflictions, and they said, let's go against them. We're not going to stand this anymore. And they kept pestering the king till he couldn't take it anymore. Notice in the sixth verse here, and they did afflict the king sorely with their complaints. So finally he granted unto them what they desired, all right, go against them, fight like dragons and see what happens this time. They gathered themselves together, put on their armor, went forth against the Lamanites to drive them out of the land. Didn't happen at all. The Lamanites beat them. There was great mourning and lamentation among the people, and there were a great many widows, and the widows started raising a rumpus, stirring up patriotic fervor here, it says. There was a great many widows. They did cry mightily from day to day, for a great fear of the Lamanites had come upon them. We've got to do something about it. And these continual cries again stirred up Limhi himself to anger, and he said, all right, we'll go out and do it this time. And they went again to battle, but they were driven back and suffered much loss. Beat again. Well, how long can this go on? They went again even the third time and suffered in a like manner. So the Lord finally says, have you learned your lesson? You're not going to take it by force. It's not going to be done that way. And so three vain attempts to free themselves by war was not the answer. God is in charge of these things. So what happens? They do the very opposite of marching forth in their might. They did humble themselves even to the dust, subjecting themselves to the yoke of bondage, not just to the Lord, but to the Lamanites, their enemies. They subjected, submitting themselves to be smitten, to be driven to and fro, burdened according to the desires of their enemies. Now, you can't go lower than that. But the point here, of course, is that was their spirit completely broken, you would say here? No, God doesn't break anyone's spirit. To be humble before him is only to be honest, as far as that goes. Everyone must be humble before something. This is a very interesting thing. In Miller's great work on Islam, in the first volume, he talks about the Khans of the steppes. The ferocious Khans of the steppes who ruled the universe. I mean, they were the cosmocrators. They ruled everything, and with bloody and absolute power. You know, the Grand Khans, Kublai Khan, and Genghis Khan, and so forth. So they accepted Islam eagerly, so that they would have a god, someone before whom they could be humble without losing face, you see. They can't be humbled before anyone without losing face, but you can be humbled before God without losing face. Of course, the Book of Mormon tells us, well, when Ether, the brother of Jared, says, you remember, God talked to me in all humility as one man to another. To be humble is not to bow down to somebody who's above you, not to lick the boss's boots, not to be subservient to higher rank, but to be equal with all of them. That's to be humble, you see. But our thing is usually to be arrogant to those below you and subservient to those above you. That's the way you get success in this world, you see. That's not to be humble at all. It's humility. Remember, the Lord himself is humble. See? He says, he spoke to me humbly just as one man to another. He didn't appear overpowering glory, that sort of thing. Well, it was that. But he says, I am meek, I'm humble, as far as that goes. So everybody's got to humble themselves to something. The idea is, what are you going to humble yourself to? Before God, it's easy, as far as that goes. That's no test at all. That's no humility. I mean, if somebody comes with overpowering might and glory and with all the splendor of a Spielberg production or Paul Lucas, the glories of space and all this sort of thing. Well, you can be humble in that sort of thing, but that isn't to be humble at all. Of course, if somebody knocks you down, you can be humble. But no, it's to be humble to speak to one as to another. The person that was really that way was George Albert Smith, President George Albert Smith. There was a man who was really humble. Never subservient, never licked it, but boy, he would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and go down to the lower part of town. This was years ago. My mother knew him very well. Some poor old bum had been picked up at the police station. He'd come down and try to help him out, bail him out, and so forth. Put himself out all the time. Nobody knew about it at all. I know some stories like that. President of the church on a big business deal in Portland, an old brother Westergaard in our ward, an old dame with a lot of girls, a poor carpenter. Well, his little girl was sick, and the president sat up with him all night with his little girl. He left the business go and everything else. And more important, that little sick child to him, to sit with old brother Westergaard. Brother Westergaard told me later about that. That was my grandfather who stayed. He founded the Oregon Lumber and Utah Light and Western Pacific, all that stuff. But no, all business had to wait so that he... And of course, he never tell anybody about a thing like that. It was Brother Restigar that told me about that years later. He said, he stayed up with me all night when I was with my little daughter. So sick. Well, so you have to humble yourself before somebody. And who's it to be? Remember, oh, how great is the nothingness. This is what, remember, Mosiah 11 and 4, you always remember this, he says, 4:11, isn't it, roommate? Always bear in mind your own nothingness and your unworthiness and so forth, and the greatness and goodness of God. How great is the nothingness of the children, well, this is Helaman talking, how great is the nothingness of the children of men, yea, they are even less than the dust. And here it says, they did humble themselves to the dust, submitting to the desires of their enemies. Now that is humility. But is it abject humility? No, it was their own sins that lay heavy on them. The Lamanites were merely an instrument. They knew that. They prayed that everyone, because they'd beaten the Lamanites badly on other occasions, greatly outnumbered by them. Pray that one may never become such an instrument, you see. Because after all, to be an oppressor is far worse than to be oppressed, as we learn here later on in Mormon 4 and 5, where he says, don't worry, he says, the justice of God will surely overtake the wicked, and it is by the wicked that the wicked are punished. Your business isn't to dominate or punish them. And it's the wicked that do the punishing, as well as the wicked that are the punished. The Lord sees to that. So, and then there's no military solution. The Lord was slow to hear them because of their iniquities, we're told in the 15th verse, which had been building up for a long time. There's no military solution but this. The Lord began to soften the hearts of the Lamanites. There must be a softening. There must be a yielding on both sides. This is sort of an anticlimax. You say, where are the heroics and so forth? The Lamanites themselves began to yield now under those circumstances. Compare the long and foolish war between Iran and Iraq. in which they just practically destroyed each other as far as that goes. Near exhaustion, accomplishing nothing, after all the mighty boasting and the unconditional damnation of the other side and all this sort of thing, the absolute idiocy. And they're still at it. Well, of course, in Lebanon, it's even worse as far as that goes. That's the only way it'll do. And even our huge naval force solved very little, didn't do anything there. So, Limhi, next, what he does in the 17th verse, notice what he does. His people are living under oppression, but they're commanded now. They're forced to live the law of consecration. It's the only way we'll ever live it, if we're forced to live it. Now, there was a great number of women, more than there were of men. Therefore, the king Limhi commanded that every man should impart of the substance to support the widows and their children, that they might not perish with hunger. And this they did because of the greatness of the number of been slain, of course, slain in vain. The people of Limhi kept together in a body as much as possible, that was the strategy, and secured their grain and their flocks. But the king didn't trust his person without the gate. See, this is going to fill up the story and take us back to Ammon, where he meets the king outside the gate. The king is out there with the patrol at night. Nobody trusts anybody else. The Lamanite king keeps constant watch over them, and they paying for the watch with the taxes he takes from them, for the grain he takes from them. And they keep watch over the Lamanites because they constantly are patrolling the borders there. King himself didn't trust the person without the walls of the city unless he took his guards with him, fearing that he might by some means fall into the hands of the Lamanite. And he caused the people to watch the land round about. See, they're keeping a check on everything here. Always on the defensive, and it's a very tense situation here. You can see that. And watch the land round about. They're going to keep an eye open and do some scouting and patrolling, I suppose, to see if they can't catch those priests, because there's the solution. There's the troublemakers who'd stolen the daughters. And because those priests had been robbing, plundering, you see, it's a rather small-scale thing going on. Like the Apaches or like the Navajos and the Hopis, the Navajos are constantly stealing sheep and things from the Navajos. They're always going over the boundary and taking them. They'd come to the land of Nephi by night and carry away their grain and many of their precious things for their supplies, their stealing horses and so forth. So they'd come and loot them, just as the Zunis do, as the One Horn Society does. There are all sorts of looting going on, these tricks. It's very dangerous in some parts of the world. I tell you, very dangerous down in the Four Corners country. If you go around, I was with a couple of characters a couple of years ago, and we had some touch and go. And it came to pass there was no more disturbance. No, things are quiet for the time being, you see. The fire-eating Gideon had urged peace through concessions here, and between the Lamanites and the people, until the time of Ammon and his brethren came into the land. Now, Ammon comes in, and this takes us up where we were before. And the story resumes at this point. Here was the king outside the gates then with his patrol, and he discovered Ammon, and he supposed them, of course, to be the priests of Noah. They'd been keeping an eye out for them all along. So what more natural? So that's why he hauled him away and brought him into court to see who he was. And when he found out who he really was, that they actually came from Zarahemla, he was filled with exceeding joy. And Limhi had sent previously to the coming of Ammon a small number of men to search for the land of Zarahemla. Now, how did Zarahemla get lost? Well, I said there you have the seven cities of Cibola and so forth. All people are always getting lost. Of course, anciently there's some good examples of lost cities in Asia, so for Lopnor, the legends of lost cities are numerous in Thousand and One Night sort of stuff. We don't go into that anyway. Well, the story resumes here. Limhi's search parties can't find Zarahemla! On what scale are they operating? Well, a good example is the Siva Oasis. The Siva Oasis is where the great shrine of Ammon was. It was a large oasis with a great temple, the most important temple, in fact, in all of Africa, more important than anything in Egypt. Some people think the Egyptian originally came from there, were Libyans that came to Egypt. But anyway, Alexander the Great looked for it, and his whole army would have perished if they hadn't been guided miraculously, according to one story, by two snakes, according to another, by two birds. But Cambyses, the mad Persian king, he went out to find it, and his whole army disappeared in the desert. They never could find it. Finding Siwa was a big thing. It was the most important oracle of the ancient world. In Hellenistic times, the people missed it very often, and yet it was this huge settlement out there in the desert. It was only 4 days' journey. It was only 4 days' journey from the Nile. So if you kept going, took in the right direction, but you can lose things like this. It may have been the desert. See, you guess, all you can guess is the type of terrain, the sort of thing that was going, and think of like things that happen. People that that miss certain things. Well, anyway, just before the arrival of Ammon, the search party returns. They had missed Zarahemla, but they'd found a land of dry bones. See, he says, Ammon, his party come in, he says, strange that you should mention it. We just had another party come in, too. Party we sent out to look for Zarahemla, they didn't find anything, but they found a lot of dry bones. And a record. His finding of dry bones on a record. I say, if you ever visit Avatoi. Avatoi was destroyed in 1700. It was in October 1700 that all the villages zeroed in on the great city. It was a city, a real city of Avatoi. And you can walk around on that mesa now, the bones, pottery everywhere. Just gotta walk miles around. You wonder, what kind of a thing was this? Immense slaughter. And then where the old part goes, there's ashes and so forth. Of course, you're not supposed to go there. The Hopis is a curse. They're ashamed of it. They won't go there. But here is the city out there, and it's just bones, and it's still lying. You can go. Well, since it's been discovered in recent years, there's lots of plunder. They keep guards over it now. The Hopis keep guards over it now to keep people from going in there and plundering, because it's just picking up. A surprising place. As I say, in 1938, Harvard spent $1 million just one corner, just excavating one corner. They find beautiful murals, the first murals ever found in that part of the country, and shrines, a sacred shrine. I got a crystal from one of the sacred shrines there, and things like that. Well, so they did find these dry bones, an impressive thing. And the people mourned for Abinadi. Remember, Abinadi had been put to death, and for the departed Alma. Remember, they left this King Noah. King Noah's people. This isn't Zarahemla. These are the Nephite people that are in bondage right now to the Lamanites, and they've been found by Ammon, who does come from Zarahemla, and they come together now. And it says they've been mourning for both of them, and they did mourn their departure, for they knew not whither they had fled. Now they would have gladly joined with them, for they covenanted they would covenant God to serve him. Alma's community disappeared. Now since the coming of Ammon, King Limhi had also entered into a covenant with God. Now Ammon said he wanted to make the covenant with God. Now Ammon, remember, does not have the priesthood the way Alma does. He is a direct descendant of Zarahemla. He's a Mulekite. He's not a Nephite. And here, Ammon, the king of Limhi, had also entered into a covenant with God. And it came to pass, King Limhi, many of his people, they wanted to be baptized. But you notice, Ammon wouldn't do it. Ammon refused to do it. He says he didn't have either authority, he wasn't worthy, he says here. None in the land that had authority from God. See, they and say, well, how about Ammon? Well, Ammon declined doing it. He considered himself unworthy. We learn in Mosiah 7 and 3 here that he was a Mulekite. Therefore, they didn't do a thing. And they did not at that time pour themselves into a church. They were waiting upon the Spirit of the Lord. Well, that's what the people were doing at Qumran, waiting upon the Spirit of the Lord. They did form a church. They were desirous to become even as Alma and his brethren. They were desirous to be baptized and witness and a testimony and an account of their baptism. Well, what did they know about Alma? Well, remember, Alma had left this community. He'd fled from King Noah, and he'd been a priest of King Noah, and he'd preached among them. They knew about this thing. And then a lot of them came back. See, those that had gone out with the priest and so on, they came back to the city again. So Alma was familiar, a familiar thing, a story in this to these people. They wanted to be like Alma, but Alma had gone now. And now all the study, because he'd gone, ended up back in Jerusalem, as we'll see. Now all the study of Ammon and his people was to deliver themselves out of the hand of the Lamanites. Well, that's the first problem. Well, we're more dealing with the enemy here in the 22nd. So they hold a general conference to discuss the matter now that Ammon is there. Ammon and King Limhi consult together. And they could see only one way out, the Rechabite discourse, to do the same thing that Nephi and that Mosiah and that Alma and that Lehi, they had all done that, namely, take off with your people as many as will go with you. See, that's a standard pattern. It happens regularly. I mean, you could list, as I say, I always come back to the Hopi because that story's there. There are at least 20 instances in which a group or a clan from a village has gone out and settled in another place, or gone out and joined to another village, or gone up to Canyon de Chelly, or gone down to Azteca, or gone down to the Little Colorado and settled other colonies, or come back there, and they move, always moving around in these groups and settling and resettling and fighting and coming together again. It's the most amazing picture. It's fluid going on all the time, and this is the sort of thing we seem to have happening here, maybe on a larger scale, maybe on a smaller, it doesn't make any difference. But so that's what they're going to do. They gather themselves together, as they did, that they might have a voice, the voice of the people. As I say, in Lonesome Dove, you have a body of people, a group of men with an awful lot of cattle, supposedly moving from the Mexican border to almost to the Canadian border, up to Montana. See, that's the way you move around, following the Indian pattern. Everywhere, wondering, running into Indians on the move the same way. You say, oh, it's dangerous, the Cheyennes are on the move now, or they're on the march, they march against each other, they burn each other's villages and so forth, back and forth. Some of them, big nations, you know, 10, 20, 50,000 people moving like that, a very impressive thing. So this is a reflection of that sort of thing. This is a prologue to that sort of thing, we might say. But it's the type of thing that's happening, you see. It's not as fantastic as you may think. They gathered themselves together, took a vote concerning the matter. Again, you see, it came to pass that they could find no way to deliver themselves except take the women, children, flocks, their herds, and depart into the wilderness. The Rechabite Act again. And now it came to pass that Gideon went forth and stood before the king. And you said, you listened to me before. Gideon is a very savvy character and a leader and a man of greatest experience among them. And he offers to submit and execute a plan of escape. He's devised a plan for escape. He'll not only submit it, but he'll execute it. I will be thy servant and deliver this people out of bondage. Hand it over to me. And the king granted unto him his wish and said, he said, do what you want to. And Gideon said, well, there's that back pass, the back wall and the back side. Everything's the back side here. And that's the Lamanites at night are drunken. This is the famous ploy. I will go according to my command, pay the last tribute of wine to the Lamanites, that they will be drunken. And notice again that ironic, humorous touch. The Lamanites don't know it, but this is the last tribute of wine they're going to get from the Nephites. They're not going to get any more after this, you see. They'll be drunken, and we will pass through the secret pass. Now, how could they do that and escape notice? it's been done time and again. Whole armies can be. Do you realize that an army of 200,000? 200,000 was mobilized within a couple of miles of the front in the Bulge. For months it went on. I was in charge. I had to keep the situation map and so forth at Mourmelon. And the reports were coming in from scouts, and from peasants would come in and tell us the story, and patrols and everything. We knew what was happening, and planes. The roads gone from the north, all crowded all night long with bicycles, wagons, anything that could move from the south, all coming to a particular point. He collected two panzer divisions, he collected six divisions there, right under our noses, and it caught the men completely by surprise, and there was no need why they should have been surprised at all, because it was very obvious what was happening. And on the night, I even said it would happen the night of December the 17th, September 17th. 1944, and it did. They hit and completely overran everything. They were there all the time for months. You could see what was happening. But the attitude was, well, we sent a couple of our fellows right down to the 7th Corps, and they put the new division, 110th or 160th. It was the Lionhead Division. They'd just come in from Normandy. They had only been a week in Europe. They'd never had any experience at all. They put them on this most sensitive place in Lama, because there's nothing going to happen here. This is a place for them to rest and get used to things and so forth. Well, they said, have you sent out any patrols? No, we're moving tomorrow. They were packing up the maps and things. Well, you don't know what's happening there? No. And you put this, the Lionhead Division, it was spread on an 8-mile front, and it should have been a quarter of a mile at most to cover that. And they had spread it over 8 miles. Well, of course, all they had to do was just walk right through. So you know it here, the first thing that happens comes a captain all black and dirty, exhausted. He comes staggering in and completely overrun us, he said. And so we had to get in these big gondolas in a hurry and get there in no time. And that's when they went to Bastogne. But But the point is that they caught us, all our intelligence and everything else, though we knew what was going on. It's this wishful thinking. It's amazing what you can get away with. I mean, here these people had the Lamanites, the Nephites under their thumbs. Life gets to be a bore. Everything's going on the same as ever. I mean, month after month, guard troops have nothing to do but see that nothing happens. If nothing happens, they fulfill their duty. So it gets very boring, and they welcome a little nip now and then, and so the wine was so welcome to them. They took it joyfully, and they passed out, and the people just went out. Now, this sort of thing has happened again and again. I think I made a wise remark here. Oh, I got a whole list of cases like that, like Singapore, Mene Peninsula. The British they couldn't point their guns in that direction because they never expected anyone would come by the Mene Peninsula, but as the famous General Zafarov said, where a deer can go, a man can go, and where a man can go, an army can go. Well, that was the Japanese policy in the Malay Peninsula. They came down the whole Malay Peninsula, and the British said they could never do that. An army could never come down the Malay Peninsula. Well, the Japs did, you see. I say their guns weren't even made to face in that direction. They could do nothing to stop them. So the Japs just overran them. That happens again and again. I've seen, especially the British are that way. They're so smug and let themselves get overrun every time. Washington at Trenton. He caught the Hessians having Christmas Eve at the time. They were drunk. They were completely at their mercy. But they didn't expect anyone to cross the river on Christmas Eve at all time, and especially a night like last night, you know. Who would ever do that? Well, it caught them completely off guard. They should have expected it at that various time. Or take the Exodus itself, or Chief Joseph, or the like. And the wine tricks worked. It works with the Hessians. It works with the Cyclops, after all. That's how Odysseus got away, you know. And I've seen whole headquarters get drunk under great tension. That really happens. And here's the paradox. The bigger the operation, the more likely it is to escape detection. Remember, the classic example is Normandy. No matter how we caught them by surprise, because Hitler insisted it was going to be the Havre Peninsula, not Cherbourg. And that went on for months. He had 10 tank divisions at Paris, and he wouldn't release them. Any one of them could have pushed us back at the greatest of ease. I mean, we didn't have a chance, not hanging on by our fingernails there. And Hitler wouldn't let a single tank division go. Any one of them would have taken care of it because he thought we would go somewhere else. See how easy it is to fool people when they have their minds made up about something. And the same thing is happening here. So the bigger operation. The first day, immediately upon landing, I picked up a mimeograph. They'd been having an operation. They'd been having a CPX on the coast there, practice for the invasion. And they had it all correct down there. Expect the first man that came out, he had his hands up and a look of surprise. He said, "We thought you were coming yesterday." Well, of course, the 5th was the day we had planned, but there was a storm, postponed it to the 6th. But they were expected to have the whole thing lined up, and that's the very reason that we were able to fool them, because they expected we'd do it just that way. We did it just that way, but then the thing that saved us was that everything went wrong with ours. Everything went wrong. There was a whole company of the 502nd landed 55 miles away from their target. Well, nothing could have been better for us than that, you see. Everything went, because the Germans said, "What on earth are they doing? Are these people crazy?" They didn't know where to counterattack. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know where to group their forces or anything else, because we were in complete confusion, scattered everywhere under the sun. The best thing that could have happened, you see. So that's the way the Lord takes care of things, as far as that goes. And so, as I say, with the bullets in them, they could have walked out on them in the middle of the night, the easiest thing in the world. I mean, this has been a matter of 2 years, you see, this has been going on, the tension built up now, and they had the Nephites where they belonged. They were completely submissive now, and if you were on a guard post, you wouldn't be worried about them. Oh, forget it. Get some sleep, for heaven's sake. And so before you know it, they've all gone. And so they pay their last tribute of wine. And the size of the escape companies. King Limhi caused his people should gather their flocks together and send more wine as a present to them. They would drink freely of the wine which King Limhi did send unto them. Again. And they went round the land of the Shalom in the wilderness toward the land of Zarahemla. And after being many days in the wilderness, they arrived in the land of Zarahemla and joined Mosiah's people. That's a short one. They got there finally and they made it. They took all their gold. It's like the Exodus, their gold and their silver and everything else. After many days in the wilderness, they arrived in the land of Zarahemla and joined Mosiah's people and became his subjects. It's like the alliances of the Latins, Greeks, and so forth. So what happens then? And after 2 days, the tracks gave out. The enemies couldn't chase them. After 2 days, their tracks gave out, and they couldn't be found by the people of Limhi, which makes us wonder what kind of terrain it was if the tracks gave out. Of course, through the woods, everything would be broken and smashed as they go along. It's obviously desert, and there could have been a strong wind and so forth, but again, you can lose tracks very easily. How can you lose track of an army? Well, it's often happened, as I say, if we could be fooled, if a whole army could be gathered within just a couple of miles of where we were, and I was making out this map every day anew and screaming to the general, what's going to happen? Look, this is what they're doing. They're obviously going to do this. Hitler's very fond of this particular time. His astrology, he's going to try to make it that, and he did. That was when they tried to make it. Well, anyway, they couldn't follow their tracks. Now the story resumes. We do and go back to Alma. Alma, having been warned of the Lord, the armies of Noah would come upon them. Remember, this is his company that fled to the wilderness. And they followed the Rechabite routine. They fled 8 days. This is another fleeing. This is another repetition of the same motif. See, I say this mobility, but this is the very nature of this civilization, is this mobility. Even though they're settled people, well, it's like the Asiatic peoples, too. Like the Americans. I mean, American frontier, we've always been on the move. How many people are living now in the houses your grandparents lived in? Well, in Europe, in Germany, we held our meetings in Salzgasse 2 in Bruxelles, an old Roman street. An old sister Glück had lived in that house, and her parents before her, and before that, and before that. And the house was almost 1,000 years old. Well, that's where we live, you see. Well, we don't do it that way. Those are stable civilizations. We don't. I mean, can anybody think of staying in Provo more than a few years, or in California more than a few years? You have to go somewhere else. Become mobile if you're going to survive now. Well, can you live without a car now? How could you make it here today without a car? Well, you walk. Well, so they fled 8 days' journey into the wilderness. They came to a land that was very beautiful, a land of pure water. That reminds you, how could a land very beautiful, inviting like that, have gone unsettled all this time? Well, when the saints came, Jim Bridger went into ecstasies about Utah Valley. He says, forget about all the rest of it. Utah Valley is barren. But there were Indians living in Utah Valley. If you go down to Lincoln Beach there, there are some marvelous, well, there are houses and everything else there, and those marvelous caves, the most beautiful collection of glyphs I've ever seen. They've been plundered all over the place. Right after the war, Princeton came out and dug there for a couple of years, and then they left. But it's dated back to the 11th century, that settlement out on the point, when the lake was way up. You can see it was a fishing place, but it had a ritual center with magnificent. There was one I was particularly fond of, which I called the Blue Goat. It was a beautiful thing, and I took Bill Russell, who was the president of Westinghouse Electric. He was a big dignity, so I'd show him around the sites, and so we went out there, and he was very interesting. And he was impressed by the Blue Goat, too. And a couple of years later, somebody comes to New York, he's seen Bill Russell. He says, isn't that marvelous, that thing of the Blue Goat he has in his office there? He sent some man out to fetch it, and he liked it, and so that was that. Of course, the law of 1906 says it's strictly against the law to plunder those, but everybody does, as you know. It's a big problem in Utah now, plundering. The best way we can do is to keep those places away from the roads. So this is what happens here. This beautiful land that not been settled before, so they go in and settle it, and begin to build buildings. See, they're going to start right in here. And we're exceeding industrious. Well, the thing that most surprised the settlers in the early days in America was that the Shenandoah Valley had never been exploited by the Indians. The most beautiful place in the world. They said, why aren't there more people there? Well, and the people were desirous that Alma should be their king. Now, this little group, they want a king. Well, the word is obviously chief throughout here. A king is a chief. This is chiefs on the same scale as the Anglo-Saxon kings, the Edwardses and the Eldrigs and all the rest of them, the Edwards and Harolds and the rest. It was small stuff, but they were kings. They were kings and we see that's the way it is, exactly. Because we have this marvelous story now about Amulon and Alma. There is a real scenario there. And what a character study between these two men here. Well, I see we've got to get going here. And they wanted Alma to be their king. Well, now he gives them a speech on being kings. It's not expedient that we should have a king, for thus saith the Lord, ye shall not esteem one flesh above another, nor shall not think one man shall not think himself above another. That is equality. I see I have noted here 24 and 8 where he says here, yeah. Oh yes, about Amnon. Well, we get to Amnon here now. And then he says, well, no, see, there's no racism, there's no elitism. Before I say unto you, it's not expedient that you should have a king. Nevertheless, if it were possible that you could always have just men like Benjamin or Mosiah, then it'd be a dandy thing, of course. And this is why, as a matter of fact, just, dikaios means king as far as that goes. Dikaios, decay, judgment. The word kinning is the one who knows. The very ancient Roman nenia that Horace recites is rex erisi recta faciet, qui non faciet non erit. You will be king if you do what is righteous, but who does not righteous automatically stops to be king, stop being king. Rex erisi recta faciet, you will be a king if you do right. Qui non faciet, who doesn't do right, non erit, will never be a king. See, because rex means king and rex means right, too, the same way. The same thing we mean rule, regulation, and right, and righteous, and all those words go together. And the keening is the one who knows, who understands, and so forth. So he says, if you could always, and that's why we can accept in Zion, we can accept an absolute monarchy, because God is the king there. He doesn't make the mistakes that men do, but anything else won't do. We don't have dominant and submissives here, the usual achievers. People of Ephesus had a rule, you know. Well, they were equalitarian, all right. They had a rule. If anybody wants to excel in anything, let him go to some other town and excel over somebody else. He said, we're not going to have anything like that. So if you're particularly good in anything, the Ephesians would always throw you out. See, they were the ones that threw Paul out. Remember, they all cheered together, great is Diana, and they stood there cheering all day long, the idiots. But they made in perfect union, and they threw anybody out that excelled in anything, they said. They let him go and excel over somebody else. That was a law with them. Nevertheless, it was possible that you could always have just men to be your kings. It would be well for you to have a king. Well, that's the only problem, of course. But remember, now here was a thing vivid in their memories, was Brother Noah. But remember the iniquity of King Noah and his priests. I myself was caught in a snare and did many things which were abominable because of his association with Noah. See, Alma himself did abominable things. He was one of the bad priests, one of the priests of Noah. So obviously he went along. That's why he had Noah's ear. That's why there was this understanding. It was when Noah defended, when he defended Abinadi, that Noah decided to have to get rid of him. He knew too much. But he went along there, and he's ashamed of it now. I did many things which are abominable in the sight of the Lord. Nevertheless, he did pray, and my prayers have been made an instrument in his hands in bringing so many to a knowledge of his truth. His prayer is what you should ask for. This is what you should ask for when you pray. He says, and my prayer has brought so many to a knowledge of the truth. Darkness covers the earth. Why? Because people don't ask for it. Remember, the Lord commands us to ask for certain things, and then we receive them. Well, I don't glory in this, though. I say unto you, ye have been oppressed by King Noah. See, they remembered that, and have been in bondage to him, and brought into iniquity of them. Therefore, ye were bound in the bands of iniquity. Now, there is the great threat to freedom. It will bind you in the bands of iniquity, not somebody who's going to take over and put you in jail and things like that. That's not it, of course. What's happened to us? Well, and also it says, even out of the hand, you've been rescued out of the hands of Noah and his people, also from the bonds of iniquity. Even so, I desire that ye should stand fast in the liberty. See, this is what liberty really is, to be rescued from the bonds of iniquity. Free, and that ye trust no man to be a king over. No man to be a king over. The emphasis is on that show. For the moment they're free, who must you fight to be free and so forth? Well, anyway, he goes on. Trust no one to be your teacher, nor your minister, except it be a man of God, walking in his ways and keeping of his commandments. Now, here's the catch here. How do you decide who is a man of God, walking in his ways and teaching his commandments? Nobody who puts himself forth for that is going to qualify. But it's actually rather easy, isn't it, to find out whether a man is. A TV evangelist is obviously a fraud, but in most cases, not always. No, they can be easily distinguished by what they do not do. For example, Ask anyone about a project, and you will get a reply. For example, the Wall Street Journal recently made a survey of over several hundred top executives on whether they thought it was necessary to cheat to prosper in business. Consistently, from time to time, you had to cut corners and to cheat. And 79% of them said, yes, it was necessary to cheat if you're going to stay in business. But see, you can find out whether a man is worthy or not by suggesting a project and seeing what kind of solution he will give. It's just like handing somebody a questionnaire. You can soon find out whether the person is a rascal or not. Though we often prefer them that way. And Alma taught his people that every man should love his neighbor as himself. There should be no contention among them. Well, how could you avoid that? He's going to tell us that. Ephraim is always under a stress. Ephraim is always the overachiever, the scripture tells us. Ephraim is always making himself obnoxious, always pushing people around and so forth. So it's a temptation. One has to control those things. Brigham Young had some, he used to say that wild horses are easy to control than his people. Anything would be easier than control than such people. Well, he should love his neighbor, but how do you get people to love their neighbors themselves? How could you avoid a contention? Now, Alma was their high priest, and this is the way he did it. He had this plan here, the same one that is used at Qumran. I see the time is up now. And he consecrated all their priests and all their teachers. They were personally consecrated by him. See, he had that authority, which Ammon didn't have. And none were consecrated except they were just men. He saw to that, like Samuel of old. Remembering he was a direct descendant of Nephi, and the priesthood was patriarchal, and he had the power to bestow it. And they did watch over the people and did nourish them with the things pertaining to righteousness. Now nourishment is increment, of course, as we learn in verse 10. And it was necessary for them to have high visibility. To nourish means to nurse, to improve the condition of a thing. And thus it came to pass that they did multiply and prosper exceedingly. And we'll end with this. And they called the city Helam. Now that's a most interesting thing, because you have the soft H, Helam, in Hebrew and Arabic. Hulmun, Hulm, sweet, it's a dream, it's various things. But Helam, the meaning of Helam is not bountiful, but it means prosperity, it means hope, it means phoenix. It's like the name Phoenix, it means new colony. It has the two with the old and the rough endings, as far as that goes, is, Helam. Oh, I got it down here from Smythe, actually. Helam means to become suitable, to be well established. Now you could name a land Helam if it was a new colony, you see. I like this one better with the small one, Chumun, as I say, that's the word, Chumun in all Semitic languages for dream. It means to be healthy, to recuperate, to restore, to revive a place, to prosper. So it was prosper. That's a better name you couldn't give, you see, to a new settlement than prosperity or restoration or health or revival or suitability or happy land or you name it. Helam was a good name, a name of good omen. So we'll end up there with Helam. And now we come, I say, to that marvelous story of Alma and Amulon. What a study in character that is.